You're listening to UK Recovery Radio, produced by the Recovery Community to inspire, promote and celebrate recovery.
Welcome to UK Recovery Radio, made by the Recovery Community to inspire, promote and celebrate recovery. Hello everyone and thanks for tuning in to the third episode of UK Recovery Radio's Purple Ball podcast.
A huge welcome and thank you to all who listened to and enjoyed our second podcast episode. We at UK Recovery Radio are glad to continue to educate, engage and inform our communities about recovery.
We are passionate about recovery. There is definitely life after addictions and we are here to inspire it, promote it, celebrate it, prove it and spread it.
UK Recovery Radio, the voice of the recovery community.
Can I ask you, what inspired your recovery? Was there one person or place or event that was your light bulb moment?
Yeah, being told that I got hepatitis C had a lot to do with it. My liver had stopped expelling toxins and I was in the beginning stages of cirrhosis and that kind of gave me a bit of a wake-up call.
Inspires me and motivates me about my job is that whilst I get some of the examples of where we might not have done it right sometimes, I also daily get inspirational stories about people's recovery journey, and that's what motivates me to get out of bed in the morning. I passionately believe that people that use our services should have good quality services wherever they need them, whenever they need them to suit their needs.
What inspired me? Society tend not to forgive people who have changed their lives. A lot of people out there who have a lot of stuff to contribute to society can't get to do it because they don't have a voice. They don't have the avenue to go through. And through Birmingham Crime Diversion Scheme, they were able to.
The key thing for me was the fact that, you know, I used to get up in the morning and think, wow, this is real life, you know, I love it, you know, recovery is brilliant, you know, you feel reborn, and it is, it's like being reborn again.
The irony with myself, I had no intention of going into recovery whatsoever, but I, through an 8-day period, I got into a certain amount of trouble with the law. I was put on alcohol treatment requirement request. Moved to Coventry from Devon and went to Back O'Connor as part of my requirement, and it all panned out as it has.
You are listening to the Purple Bull Podcast. Start your recovery journey here.
In the third Purple Bull Podcast episode, we will be looking into stigma in society that is faced by people recovering from addictions, with Lee Collingham, Paul Street and Clifton Cameron amongst other professionals and service users.
We will have a roundup report of this year's UK Recovery Walk, as well as episode 3 of Step Up to the Plate, where the group discussion looks into what the third step of recovery means to different people. Stay tuned.
Recovery is like a camera. You take the negatives and turn them into positives.
In previous episodes of the Purple Ball podcast, we looked into the premise of recovery and harm reduction. In this episode, we investigate the barriers and the psychological drivers that affect people who have experienced an addiction and strive to live a socially accepted, normal life again. All of which seem to stem from society's depiction of recovery, addiction and those who have suffered and won the battle of addiction.
With this in mind, we wanted to find out where stigma comes from and how we can break down the stigma faced by many recovering and recovered ex-addicts on a daily basis, making their life harder to deal with.
Stigma is two ways, really. You'll get the stigma from people who are service users, who perhaps feel that they've had a rough deal from the police, that it's purely around enforcement. There can be stigma from agencies around people who drug use and abuse, and that's well documented, what people may or may not think. And there's a sort of saying around, it's okay, but not in my backyard, you know, and it's very, very much around stigma. Oh, that happens, oh, that's terrible, you know, but it's actually happening in your road, oh, that's totally intolerable, we've got to do something about it.
There's a phrase that says regime change begins at home, And I think in terms of recovery, I think stigma can be actively broken down by ourselves, because as individuals, I think that once our self-esteem starts to rise and we start to understand that we maybe don't love ourselves, but we do like ourselves, that once we start to like ourselves, things start to improve.
My name is Clifton Cameron, and I'm the Managing Director of Birmingham Crime Diversion Scheme and Birmingham Youth Empowerment Project. If you give people a chance, I know from experience you have people who society say that can't change. But for every action, there's a reaction. So I say that to say this. What my experience taught me is that anything you see someone do, there must be a reason for it. So if someone is taking drugs and is continuing taking drugs, you need to find out what is affecting that person. What caused that person to be taking drugs? What's the problem? And if you address the problem, I guarantee you, you will be able to solve that problem.
I think it's everybody's responsibility, because a lot of the stigma we put upon ourselves anyway, and we allow people to stigmatise us themselves, and just by challenging it within our own working practices and day-to-day lives, and also with other people as well, not accepting it, I think.
I'm Sergeant Paul Street. I'm from the Corporate Partnership Team for Westmorland Police. The main way to get over stigma on both sides is education. It's about understanding the issue first, and then it's about being positive about how you move on. Because what stigma is wrapped in negativity. It doesn't matter how you look at it, but if you've got stigma, you've got negativity, and you'll never move on. You know, drug users will continue to be drug users. Police officers and other enforcement agencies will continue to be enforcement agencies as long as stigma exists.
Essentially, I think the underpinning thing about all this is addictions is a health issue, and if it could be clearly pegged in that and stuck in the public psyche as a health issue, I think that would be a massive help. If you see adverts now about mental health issues, if you look at the way it's a mental health issue, if you like, addiction is, that's the way it's viewed within treatment services. Birmingham Solihull Mental Health Trust, for example, have an addictions unit, and instead of it being mixed up in a criminal justice kind of setting, really, and I think if it was treated as a health issue, that would help stigma.
By breaking down our self-stigma, we are empowering ourselves to believe that we are capable of fitting in the society which we've hitherto perceived as not wanting us. And I think that we can take a lot of guidance from other minorities, such as the gay community.
If you look at it in the law of attraction way, if people are focusing on we've got to change people's perception and we've got to change people's views, that's not going to work, because what you give your attention to just gets bigger. You know, the only way that we're going to focus change it is by being the change.
And concepts such as gay pride, where ultimately these people are proud of their reality, and that pride is taken out and exhibited to the general public. And in that pride is that self-belief, and in that self-belief is the self-esteem, and in that self-esteem is the happiness and the ability to be able to walk tall and walk proud. And I think that's what's changing. And the recovery agenda itself, at the core of it, I think that's what the heart of it is. I think it's about standing up and saying, you know, I've had problems and I've been wrong, but I'm better now.
One of the biggest debates within the recovery community in regards to stigma is that of the social treatment of alcoholism compared to drug addiction.
Alcohol is a substance that is still advertised within the media and communities in an era where even cigarettes have been banned from being publicised. We investigated if someone with an alcohol problem is treated the same way as that of someone with a drug addiction.
Simon Morgan, James Forsyth and Maxine King gave us their take on this.
No, it doesn't. Of course it doesn't. in society. There's half licenses everywhere. There's people drinking everywhere. Well, there's people who binge drink. There's people who drink after work. There's people who drink in the afternoon. Of course it doesn't. That's a no.
That's one of the big problems, is that it's normalised. Completely and utterly normalised. And because they tax us on it. So they are... And I mean, they...
That's it. That is it. Taxation and normalisation. Do you have to embellish on any of that? That is it.
Alcoholism is... Well, it seems to be the lesser of the two addictions. Have you ever heard anyone speak fondly of a drug user? I don't think so. Whereas an alcoholic is referred to as, oh, he likes a drink. She likes a good time. There's no difference in the two. Addictions, wherever they are, cause huge damage to everybody concerned.
In my own view, my own personal view, I think it gets off a bit more lightly. Because I find people will accept alcohol use and perhaps abuse a bit more than drug abuse.
It receives a similar stigma, but it's a stigma of a different kind. As I'm sure you're aware, there's an hierarchy, and drugs seems to be at the bottom of that ladder. It seems to be okay for people to be able to go out and get levered on alcohol after working all week, and that's not a problem, and getting locked up and getting into fights. However, if it was drug-related, then all of a sudden you're a bad person, so I think it's very unequal, and there are different issues within those two groups as well. Bearing in mind, a lot of people actually misuse both substances at the same time as well.
One of the things that we do as a society is that we will glorify it in some senses. You know, you've got a picture of some guy with a bottle of Thunderbird lying at a bus stop, and everybody thinks that's really sad, but you've got a picture of, I don't know, some rock star, you know, pulling three chicks out of a taxi with a bottle of Jack Daniels in his hand, and that's cool.
What's more harmful? They are both harmful. They will both impact on your health. The social pressures, I think, are bearing down more on drugs than what they are on alcohol. But they are being treated the same as far as a controlling authority. Drug and alcohol abuse are neck and neck in priority around how they're dealt with.
The media plays a big role in how the public perceives something, and seems to be the be-all and end-all of what really underlies in the world of recovery and addiction, with people who are trying to be part of everyday society again. Which made us wonder if it would be possible to one day change society's and the strong medium that is the media's reaction to recovery and addiction.
Yes, if society do some of the recommendation that I am recommending. You understand? Clean them up. Give them something to do. Let them know that people love them and they are useful human beings.
This is an issue close to my heart, really. I mean, the public read headlines stating addict mugs old lady. You're looking at the Daily Mail. That's what you'll find. And indeed, there are addicts out there who will go to any lengths to feed their habit. But that can be said to be true of any part of society. People mug old ladies when they're not addicted to drugs.
The media has a vested interest in the continuity of glorifying it because it sells papers.
It sells papers, it sells red tops, of course.
It sells red tops, it makes soap operas seem interesting.
In the criminal justice system, there are a lot of ex-offenders who are involved in the rehabilitation of other ex-offenders. And you're not going to hear a lot of talking about that. These are people who used to do a lot of wrongs, and they turn around their life. Some give up drugs, fast car, a lot of money, to do something to help back society. And you don't hear the one talk about them and give them the respect that is due.
We've got to somehow put this over to the public. Anywhere you go, any sort of set of people will always have a view about addiction and addicts. An addict is somebody's son, somebody's daughter, somebody's husband. Not this monster going round mugging old ladies.
How many times have you seen some kind of dependency problem in EastEnders or Emmerdale? You know, you wouldn't have thought a few years ago that you'd have ever had any heroin problems in Emmerdale, but it's like rock and roll, you know? It's like everybody wants to be Sid Vicious, but nobody wants to be dead, you know? Everybody wants to be Kurt Cobain, but nobody wants to blow their brains out.
The media have a role to play here, and they have a role to play around education, because they reach a wide audience, and that is a medium that needs to be tapped into.
So with the media's influence on creating a stigma around addictions, should more be done to educate communities about its consequences, and what can be done to counteract this?
Well, anything helps, but really speaking, I think it's up to those who work in addiction.
I know that certain agencies and stuff, you know, do work really hard to try and break that down, but at the end of the day, they do have a full-time job. So I think maybe there should be a centralised database, if you like, of people in recovery. Maybe it's part of giving something back. You know, but obviously with relevant training, you know, lone working training, that sort of thing, because obviously you wouldn't just send somebody out there without risk assessing and so forth, you know.
A lot of the times I think a lot of people in society would view addicts as selfish people, someone that inflicted that social issue on themselves, therefore why should they receive any help services? It's all down to the individual, and to a large extent it is down to the individual and their personal attitude. But if that individual needs help, people around or society as a whole, we should have services in place to reach out to those people.
I just think it gets a lot of people down, to be honest. Too much paperwork. Not enough quality time, to be honest.
I personally think the way we treat people who commit crime, the way we treat people who have addictions, and hopefully, this is an optimist view, in 100 years' time we'll look back and think, oh my God, did we really do that? Did we really all lock them on wings and kind of, like, not really bother rehabilitating and think punishment was going to do them or send them good? And I don't mean that from, like, they call it hugging junkies, some people. I don't mean it like that. What I'm saying is, the way to stop victims is to stop a person committing crime. That's the way to stop victims, so it's in society's interest to do that, and I think we lose that. We want to punish someone. Same with people in addictions.
With the United States leading the way with recovery programs and initiatives where disclosure of someone's past addiction is widely encouraged and even accepted on a business card, we wondered if, when compared with the United Kingdom, is the USA more grown up and forgiving in its attitude towards stigma?
Yeah, no, I mean, well, America's obviously a newer culture, for starters, isn't it? It's much newer, and they are more open. Everything is an affliction in America. They have a self-help group or a kind of therapy for everything.
I think it's more grown up where addiction and crime is concerned, because in the fields that I am in now, you get more recognition in America than in the UK. The UK just barely itching on.
I wouldn't say more grown up. I would perhaps use a softer term to say that they tend to set trends before we do. And when you look at what happens in America and what happens in the UK, we tend to follow, more or less. We might be a few years behind, but the Americans have a very evangelist, open outlook on life. Certainly the Americans I've met and spoke to. Where there's not a lot of taboo subjects, I think we're still a bit stuffy in the UK, and we're still a little bit reserved.
America's got a lot of terrible things wrong with it, but it's also got a lot of good things. Personally, I will bore anybody to death that comes anywhere near me about my recovery. It's a celebration, I'm proud of it, and ultimately, yeah, why not have a business card?
I think we're still a bit stuffy in the UK, and we're still a little bit reserved, where, you know, Americans are often described as loud or brash. It's not, they're open, they're just, here I am, this is me. I can see a lot of benefits with people being quite open and upfront around coming from recovery. There should be no unspeakable issues. And so if somebody's had an issue and said, well, yeah, I'm 5 years clean, well, isn't that to be celebrated? Or, you know, should we brush it under the carpet if it means nothing? Or it's disgusting and we shouldn't talk about it? Absolutely not.
UK Recovery Radio, giving a voice to the recovery community.
The 22nd of September 2013 saw the 5th annual Recovery Walk take place here in Birmingham.
It was a momentous and spectacular occasion which saw people from all walks of life and all over the UK come together to celebrate their recovery journey. It was a day that will always be remembered. What does the UK Recovery Walk mean to you?
What it means to me is just people getting together from all walks of life, all different kinds of recovery, getting together to celebrate the achievements that have been happening.
It didn't really mean anything to me until I came here, and I've seen everyone here and just seen what it's doing for them. It's brought memories of lost ones and my kids. It's just everything. It just means everything to be here, and everyone else is having a good time.
It means a celebration, a massive joyous occasion where you've got people in recovery who are either starting that journey or many years through it, actually celebrating the fact they've managed to change their lives around and they're getting on with life. And the substance that used to drag them down is no longer an issue for them, and they're working hard, which is fantastic. And it's good that they're all here making a big noise.
What it means to me is about supporting all these people that are in recovery, giving them inspiration to continue that recovery. And the sun's out, what a better day to have a nice clear day, to have a nice walk in the park, bit of food, nice people, nice music, and hopefully another one next year.
Do you believe a walk is a way to go to help change the way ex-addicts are treated in society?
I think so, yeah. There's a lot of stigma about addicts and alcoholics, and for good reason as well, you know, but with the press, most of the stuff you hear in the press are bad stories about, you know, drug dealing and crime that's been committed, and you don't hear much about the results, you know, the joys that are happening and the successes that are happening around the city. And as you've seen today, we've had about 6,000-7,000 people walking through the city, all in recovery with their families. You know, there's some amazing stories, people getting their families back, people getting jobs. You know, they never dreamed of having that, so this is an ideal opportunity for people to come together and celebrate and to show the public, you know, that this is possible. Because most people out there in the community have got someone, either family or friends, that have been affected by addiction or alcohol. So they can pass that message on and tell them, you know, that recovery is possible. If they think they're stuck and locked in to addiction, now they're going to know different.
Well, it can't make things any worse, can it? Do you know what I mean? Obviously, walking through towns like this, you could do this right across the country, and then it raises other people's awareness, you know what I mean? Because there comes a lot of stigma when it comes to addiction and drugs and alcohol, crime, and you just have to get the awareness out there, I suppose.
I think it's a really good, visible message to give to those people who don't know anything about recovery. There's a stereotype of people who are doing substance misuse, be it alcohol or drugs or anything else. And we're all often viewed, apart from the close family and relatives, as down and outs and whatever. And the fact that you've got several thousand people wearing the T-shirts, smiles on their faces, walking through the city centre to this park is fantastic. And it gets people notice, you know, thinking, what's all this about? And it's good. You know, we're not hidden away anymore.
The walk is a good for everybody that's here to be around, like people that are going through exactly the same. I think it's also good for society to see that as we've walked through the city of Birmingham, there is a big community of people in recovery who want to take their life forward. Hopefully that the city of Birmingham has seen that today.
And finally, what do you think the legacy of the UK Recovery Walk 2013 will be?
Well, the legacy, I mean, it's just grown and grown every year, you know. I mean, I went to the one in Brighton, there was 3,000 people and it was just superb. And you know, what? There's a great big turnout today, and I just think the legacy will just continue, the movement will continue, and we'll hope to inspire more and more people across the city and across the country.
The legacy will be a nice sunny day, the camaraderie, people from all over the country here. It started at 10 o'clock for me in Victoria Square. I'm going to slowly walk off myself with a smile on my face and look forward to next year's.
The legacy should be handing on the baton to whoever, I think it's Manchester next, and the aim would be they capture the good stuff, the good planning, the good events that are going to happen here today, take that with them and actually make it bigger and better next year. And if we got 5,000 people here, they should be aiming to get 10 for next year. It'd be great.
UK Recovery Radio, building networks in the recovery community.
As part of UK Recovery Radio's ongoing commitment to inspire, promote and celebrate recovery, we bring you the third episode of our Step Up to the Plate series, where a panel drawn from the Birmingham recovery community turns their thoughts and opinions to the third step and how they interpret and apply their understanding to their everyday lives.
Feelings. I've been thinking for a while what to write about for a second article. I wanted to continue on the track I started on with the first article, keep coming back. But all of the ideas I had were coming from my head. I was thinking of topics to write about that would make me sound like I knew a bit about recovery. Wow, can't he write well? all that sort of thing. Affirmation seeking. So the article didn't get written, because it didn't feel right. I woke up this morning and I knew what I was going to write. I was going to sit down and write about feelings, because I've had a few to deal with over the last few days, and I'm still clean. There's a lot said about feelings in recovery, a lot of cliches bandied about. Feelings aren't facts. Feelings won't kill you. Drugs and drink will. Your feelings aren't your whole life. Throwaway lines we say to one another, like that's the answer. One thing I've learned since getting clean and staying clean, sometimes there isn't an answer. Sometimes we just have to feel our feelings. I heard this in a meeting I attended recently. It takes a lot of courage to walk through feelings. I ran away from feelings my whole life, or bought the ones I wanted in bottles, wraps and bags. We talk in 12-step about drugs being a symptom of a disease, how we're the problem, not the drugs. Sometimes I think drugs were my solution for a long time, but they became a solution that caused me so many additional problems. They made me do things I didn't want to do, be someone I didn't want to be, and they were killing me. So I can't buy my feelings on the corner or in the off-license anymore. I have to face them, feel them and walk through them. It's not always easy. I'm an intelligent man. I used to think I could intellectualise my way out of feelings. It's the right decision. It didn't work out. It's the best thing for both of us. Doing the right thing doesn't make it easy. Doesn't take away the pain. Sometimes the best thing, the only thing that anyone can say or do, is be there, listen to you, offer you a hug and tell you it will get better. There's only one truth I know and believe to be unshakable, cast iron, 100% solid gold. If I don't use, things will, in time, get better. If I use, they'll get worse, quickly, and I might die. I've had times in the last 9 months I've had to make tough decisions, which intellectually, rationally, were the right thing. They weren't the easy thing. I've cried a lot of tears and felt a lot of feelings. I've wanted to use, not just because I want to feel that buzz, but because I don't want to feel the way I'm feeling. I've cried down the phone to my sponsor, and he's listened, and he's asked me, "You still clean?" Great. So am I. That's good, isn't it? That's the bottom line for me today. There's a book I read that tells me every clean day is a successful day. No one said it was going to be easy. But it's easier than waking up in hospital with your mother sobbing by your bedside. It's easier than sitting in a police cell, rattling. It's easier than running down the road from security guards. It's easier than selling yourself short on a daily basis, doing whatever and walking over whoever you need to get one more. Today, I give myself permission to feel my feelings. It's okay to admit when things hurt. It's okay to fall short. 9 months in, I'm starting to recognise feelings I don't think I've ever felt before. It's not all bad. Far from it. Another cliche. The best thing about recovery is you get your feelings back. The worst thing about recovery is you get your feelings back. For all the pain and tough decisions I've made since last July, I've had moments of indescribable joy and happiness. Laugh more than I've ever laughed. I'm developing a relationship with myself and finding a bit of compassion for myself too. It's okay to be me today. What a gift.
Step three, often seen from the outside as a step that can put people off because it mentions the word God. So what we're going to do, we're going to try and look at this and delve into how God sort of involves himself in the 12-step program. So step three is we've made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. So anyone want to take this up and see what it means to them?
First of all, it's a decision that we make, so it's an individual thing. It's not like somebody makes a decision for you. Like me personally, I make a decision. I'm going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him, which gives me a lot of scope as well. It doesn't narrow it down. I just want to quickly just mention that 12-step recovery is recognised around the world as got a higher success rate of keeping people drug-free and alcohol-free than any other tried method. And that's a fact. It's not something I'm making up to promote 12-step recovery. It's a fact. It's world recognised. 12-step recovery is saving lives everywhere. That any city you go in England or in most places around the world, there'll be a meeting somewhere and people will be doing 12-step recovery. I make that point because the word God shouldn't put you off from a life of living drug-free. You know, one word should not cut you off from living a life free from using drugs or alcohol.
I've got some appreciation
of the word and belief in that word because of my background. The apprehension or difficulty I sometimes have is coming from actually that belief, in the sense that my understanding of God is that he gives us free will to make decisions for ourselves. You know, this kind of step kind of, in my view, is at variance with that belief, that we have to now give that choice and decision-making process over to someone else. It's like we're removing ourselves from it and absolving ourselves of responsibility and saying, yeah, God, you do it. I'm not going to be involved in this. You take control. I don't see how that happens. And so that's kind of like, to me, where I feel some questioning of that particular concept. And also, what about people like atheists or agnostics? How do they grapple with those issues?
When we talk about God as well, we can look at God in a number of different lights. There's a guy that created the planet, and he's, or the guy that points the finger and says, you done this and you done that. You can, you know, or you can look at it how we look at it. We have a specific criterion for God of your understanding that we suggest you use, and it is something that's peaceful, non-judgmental. It's something that just caring, loving, wants the best for you. So whatever that may be, that's the God of your understanding. Sometimes the word God puts people off, and we even look at that and say, all right then, look at it as an acronym. Look at it like for Get Off Drugs, G-O-D, or Good Orderly Direction, something that's centering your focus away from the negative into the positive, basically, you know. So anybody that struggles with the word God, it's something for you. It's an individual. Recovery is individual. Anybody that struggles with the word God, I suggest you have a look at the program and choose a God of your understanding.
I have to go back to when I was trying to access treatment, and I was looking online, and when I seen the word God, I was a bit like some of the guys here, that I really struggled around the whole God thing, because I had no understanding about what it really meant. And I went to treatment and got introduced to 12-step through the treatment centre that I was in. I realised after a few times of people coming in and out that it wasn't my perception of what God was. I was brought up, with a God-fearing, if you don't do this, God, you know, it was always kind of, I was like afraid of the word God, really. And it wasn't until I came into the fellowship meetings that I realised that it was a God of your understanding. And that really kind of, rather than being told that you were praying to just like one God and everybody's facing one way and all, it was my own personal belief, faith. You know, I'm not a religious person, but I do consider myself quite a spiritual person. And it's only from doing regular meetings that I've kind of come to understand what God actually means. It's not the God that you've pictured in your head from childhood or what you're told to be. It's a totally different kind of experience. It can be different people's perceptions. Some people have God as, you know, Jesus and stuff like that. Other people, it's, you know, the earth around them. It's the other people that keep them, you know, that they've met on their journey, that's kind of helped them to stay clean. And it's the rooms, it's groups, it's different kinds of recovery, you know. I know people that have, like, the sun and stuff is what they would consider their God of their understanding. Step three wasn't a big deal for me, really, because the previous steps had put me in good stead to advance to step three and be ready to take that step. You know, I do think it's a little bit, to a person that has never heard of it before, you know, came make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to God as we understood him, is a big thing, because, you know, you're not prepared for it. But with the other steps previous to it, it can be a really, it's just becoming closer contact with your spiritual side. That's what I find.
Can I just add on to what Steve was just saying? We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Now, I used drugs, alcohol, whatever, for 28 years. So on a daily basis, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of something that wanted to kill me. You know, I made the decision to go to the off license and turn my will and my life over to the care of the guy who was selling me the alcohol. I made a decision to phone a drug dealer and turn my will and my life over to his care and trust whatever substance he was giving me wasn't going to kill me that day. You know, when I actually injected it, you know, I wasn't going to die that day. That's a decision I made on a daily basis. That's why I think the wording's actually correct, you know. They don't just come up with this wording out of the blue, you know, for the program. They come up with the wording to align itself with what you were doing. And now I know I've turned my will and my life over to the care of something destructive. That's what you call blind faith. You know what I mean? Because that's absolutely blind. I haven't got a clue what this substance is going to do. I haven't got a clue it's even the substance I'm being told it is. And I'm willing to take it, put it into a bloody syringe and inject it.
I'd just like to say, just touching on what you was just saying, I've 14 days clean from injecting. And while I've been here, I found out that I've had a blood clot in my leg. And it's been there for a few weeks. And I'm not spiritual. I've never really been to church or anything like that. But I can say one thing is that it happened for a reason, finding that blood clot while I was here, otherwise I probably would have been dead. So I don't know, you know, I think somebody or something is watching out for me and I'm open to possibilities, but it's early days for me and I hope to get where I want to be.
It obviously is the word God that freaks people out with this. And in other parts of the programme it's referred to as a higher power. And someone's mentioned religion and faith and the difference between it, and in my view religion is when someone else interprets God for you and tells you what you should think about God and tells you how to react to it, whereas faith is when you kind of like have more of a finding it of yourself. And I can find faith in this room, you know, despite the fact there's a bunch of addicts all sat in a room or talking about sort of recovery. This is not something I did a year ago. I can get faith from sort of 12 step to fellowship meetings that I attend on a regular basis, and faith from from a text I receive in the morning from a fellow addict. So it's not just necessarily a one supreme being. It is, say, a higher power that I'm more than prepared to accept. I don't have to understand it. And there's lots of phrases come out of sort of 12-step fellowship, and there's a phrase called like handing over in the morning and prayer life again, which all sort of feeds into this kind of thing. Oh, it's a bit religious. But for me, my prayer life involves me thinking about my family and my kids, my friends and colleagues, other addicts that are still suffering in the world. And I'm just giving 5 minutes of my time, whether it's sort of when I first get up or whether the first 5 minutes I get after I've sorted my kids out, when I'm driving to work, some time to myself to give some thought to other people other than myself, because just over a year ago, the only person I ever thought about was myself.
Just because I hand my will over to a God of my understanding, it's still me that ultimately makes the decisions. But with the faith that I'm being helped along the way, it's still me that makes my mistakes. It's still me. It's not like I've handed my will over and that's it. I'm good to go. It's still a lot of work takes place. I fall flat all the time. I make mistakes all the time. It's an easier way because I'm getting help from other people in the fellowship that I have friends with. And I do believe recovery is a lot easier with peer support than it is on your own. That's what I strongly believe, because there's always safety in numbers and you got to learn more and you don't listen to your own head, which is usually can tell you any kind of stuff.
I've heard three different things now. Yeah. Recovery is a personal journey, it's a spiritual journey, but it's also a disease. How can it be all three?
It's me, you know, for something wrong with my thinking, you know, and my thinking said to me, go on, use drugs. You're with me, go on, have a drink. That's me. So it's personal to me. When I start dealing with that. If I don't want to go to a meeting, I don't have to go to a meeting. There's nobody telling me I've got to. If I don't want to do 12-step work, there's nobody telling me that you, hold on, you're not welcome here because you don't do no step work. You're welcome whether you do the step work or not. I access the fellowship, and I tell you the truth, I milk it. There's something on offer there. I see it as a beautiful gift. I'm not going to take just half of the gift, am I? It's for me. It's been given to me here. This is for you.
More reflecting on the disease part of it, I had a group of friends I was growing up with using a lot of drugs, using different kinds of drugs. They were able to stop. And if it was that simple, I really would have just stopped. I couldn't stop. You know, that's where I feel, yeah, perhaps I do have a disease. I have to find a way to overcome it.
It's something I never asked for. I never woke up one day and said, oh, I'm going to just go and be an addict. You know, it happened. So I've got a disease. I surrender to a spiritual program to arrest my disease, and it's individual to me.
UK Recovery Radio, taking recovery one step at a time.
In episode 4 of the Purple Ball podcast, we will be looking into the transition of getting back into employment from recovery and talking to employment and education providers about some of the opportunities and initiatives that are available to help people in recovery get back into work.
There will be part four of Step Up to the Plate, our 12-step discussion forum, and more reports and items to inspire, promote and celebrate recovery.
You have been listening to the Third Purple Ball podcast for UK Recovery Radio.
Reports and interviews were by Simeon, Jane, Paul and Humphrey.
With contributions from Stinder Joel, Steve Dixon, Lee Collingham, Simon Morgan and James Forsyth.
Editing and production was by Simeon.
UK Recovery Radio was started with an award from Birmingham and Solihull NHS Mental Health Foundation Trust.
You can interact with us on these social networks, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, LinkedIn, or email us at recovery.radio@yahoo.co.uk.